Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 140, Understanding Jungian Typology, February 29th, 2008. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
Jung simply felt that the attempt to try to impose a model of the mind on the psyche was exactly what it didn't need. What it needed was this kind of empathic understanding, which would start with the premise that not everyone uses the mind in the same way. So it seems to me that that was the true origin of psychological types, and then explaining the differences between himself and Freud and Adler was almost secondary to this being a true assertion of what he felt psychology itself should be.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. John Beebe. John Beebe, M.D., is a Jungian analyst in practice in San Francisco. He received degrees from Harvard College and the University of Chicago Medical School. He is a past president of the C.G. Jung Institute of San Francisco, where he is currently on the teaching faculty as well as assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of California Medical School, San Francisco. He's a distinguished fellow of the American Psychiatric Association. A popular lecturer in the Jungian world, Dr. Beebe has spoken on topics related to the theory and practical applications of analytical psychology to professional and lay audiences throughout the United States, as well as Canada, China, Denmark, England, France, Italy, Germany, Israel, Mexico, and Switzerland. Dr. Beebe is the founding editor of the San Francisco Jung Institute Library Journal. Now, here's the interview. Dr. John Beebe, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hello.
Well, I'm really pleased to have you here today. Actually, I got the idea for doing this interview because I heard from a listener that they would like to hear something about Jung's typology. And I know that one of your specialties is Jung's theory of types.
That's right.
But before we get into that, I'd like to start out with a little on your background as a Jungian analyst. How did you first discover Jung?
It happened really quite early.
When you say quite early, how old would you have been at that time?
I was 18 years old.
Oh, that is early, yeah.
Yes, I was an undergraduate at Harvard, and actually my first exposure to Jung was between age 17 and 18 during my freshman year. I took a course that in those days Harvard was very much pushing what was then called general education. And so one had, as a freshman, to take courses in natural sciences, in the humanities, and in social sciences. And the course in social sciences was taught by Clyde Kluckhohn and Henry Murray. And Henry Murray is the man who created a very famous test called the thematic apperception test, where people show various pictures.
Sure, the TAT is its name.
TAT,
yeah.
And then people read the implied story. And it's actually, in many ways, quite a Jungian test, and it was developed by Henry Murray and Christiana Morgan, who were both patients of Jung. Now, he didn't talk about that in his course, but he was extremely unusual for the Academy in that period in talking about Jung. Now we're I was a freshman at Harvard between the years of 1956 and 1957, and those were years when psychoanalysis and ego psychology were very much strongly dominant. Erik Erikson had written his great book on childhood and society in 1950.
Mm-hmm.
And that, too, had a Jungian bent, but no one knew it. They thought of it as a psychoanalytic book. One English critic said it was somewhat Jungian. But Jung as a name was not in good odor. We were only 11 years after World War II, and there was a lot of perception that Jung was anti-Semitic and had somehow, at least rhetorically, supported some aspects of Nazism. So we didn't have that word then, but he was certainly politically, we wouldn't have said incorrect, but in those days we had you and non-you. It was even before in and out. We had you and non-you came out in those years, and he was definitely non-you. In other words, you could say not upper class or in the intellectual world, or maybe even better, non-university. The university didn't like Jung. So there was Henry Murray rather openly talking about Jung and actually assigning us Modern Man in Search of His Soul. So that was quite an eye-opener. The other teacher, Clyde Kluckhohn, was a very famous anthropologist, and he had us reading Childhood and Society. So from a very early time, I had a kind of sense of a development that lasts the whole life long, and I had a sense that dreams were important, and I had a sense that maybe Jung was okay. Maybe there was something good there, which was not the way everybody else was talking about him.
Yeah, do you remember
the beginning?
Yeah, do you remember what it was that grabbed you as you read that first work by Jung? Was it that longitudinal view of life, or do you recall what it was that kind of really connected for you?
I think in those days I was very much what Erikson was talking about, a young man preoccupied with finding himself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I kind of loved the idea that there was a true self somewhere. I think that was the idea that was really exciting, the idea that there was a way to be precisely yourself. That somehow probably caught me. None of this, however, happened in any kind of conscious way in which I suddenly claimed myself as a Jungian. That's not the way my nature goes. It's just that my ears were perked up, and my interest was aroused. And that very first summer after my freshman year, I'd made a friend in my natural science class whose mother was a writer, and that interested me a great deal because I was in those days majoring in English and thinking that I was going to be a novelist. So here was a friend at Harvard. So many of the undergraduates have parents who are rather famous, and I used to tick off the numbers of people that I was in classes with, whose parents were well-known, like Lena Horne's daughter and Ilya Kazan's son and that kind of thing. And so this woman, Nancy Hale, was not a celebrity at quite that level, but she did hold the record for publishing the most stories in the New Yorker in 1 year. She published 17 stories in 1 year.
That is impressive.
In the mid-50s, she was pretty well-known. named Nancy Hale, and so I was so eager to meet her, and we were good friends. So I spent a summer in Cape Ann, Massachusetts, which is where Nancy Hale and her mother, who was a painter, kept a house, and this friend of mine, and I went to stay for a while, and then I got a place of my own to live and got a job working in a restaurant and stayed that summer. My real interest was in talking to her about what it was like to be a writer. She was 50 then, I was 18. But what she couldn't stop talking about was her Jungian analysis with Beatrice Henkel, who was the first Jungian analyst in America, and it translated Jung's book, The Psychology of the Unconscious. And so she just filled me with all kinds of things about writing her dreams down every day, what it had meant to her to try to live for other people, and then breaking down in that process and having to really listen to who she was. And so I got a very practical sense very early of what it was to be in Jungian analysis. Next thing I knew, I went back to Harvard, and in the next year, I saw a sign saying, help a child who's mentally ill, and I started working as a volunteer at the children's unit of the Waltham of the Metropolitan State Hospital in Waltham, Mass., not very far from Walden Pond. And volunteers got a certain amount of in-service training. One person who talked to us every week was also volunteering, working with a retarded child, and that was Robert Coles, who later became rather famous, as you know, writing about children and their vicissitudes in various social situations. And he was at that time, as I recall, a psychiatric resident. So that turned me on so much that by the end of the year, I suddenly realized that I wanted to be a psychiatrist. So I was sorely troubled, and I went and I talked to my friend Nancy Hale. It was on my 19th birthday, and I went and I had I took a train ride from Boston to Rockport, Massachusetts, and went to see her at that beautiful house overlooking the rocks leading into Cape Ann, and I told her that I thought I wanted to be a doctor, and she said, "Well, you know, if you're going to be a doctor, you can't be a writer. You know, you it's one or the other in terms of what your primary thing is." And I said, "Well, I hope I can write something," I said. And she said, "Well, yes, psychiatrists write wonderful books, but it's not the same as being a full-time writer. You'll be a full-time doctor, and it's a very self-sacrificing life." She said, "You know, my old beau, when I was in my teens, I had a beau who later became a psychiatrist, and he worked so hard that he got tuberculosis. And he's out in San Francisco now. I don't know what he's doing." And that turned out to be Joe Wheelwright, who founded the Jung Institute of San Francisco. We're sitting in Massachusetts, and I've just discovered I want to be a psychiatrist.
Yes, interesting.
She's talking about the man who founded the C.G. Jung Institute of San Francisco, yeah, where I was later to train as a Jungian analyst.
Yes, and that you're still associated with.
It was all laid out for me by my 19th birthday.
Wow. Yeah, now,
so it was sort of intuitive. You see, I just sort of found my way.
Yes, that's wonderful. Now, are you of that generation that was analyzed by someone who was analyzed by Jung himself, or are you too young for that?
Yes, I was. I had three analysts, and all of them had had contact with Jung, and one had had a full analysis with Jung. And the one who'd had the full analysis with Jung was Joseph Henderson, and I was with him for over 20 years.
Oh, my goodness.
And the Freudians have something to say about this. It's sort of they call it the family romance. it's a sort of the psychoanalytic version of the apostolic succession. You have a fantasy that you belong to some kind of royal family because your analyst was analyzed. It's your psychological family's romance. That your analyst was analyzed by. And nevertheless, I found it very helpful in my case because Joe Henderson had really resolved his transference to Jung, and although he became a Jungian, he became his own person and developed his own theory of how the unconscious receives the archetype, which he called the cultural unconscious, which was very influenced by some of the ideas of Claude Clocone.
I like that term, cultural unconscious. I hadn't heard that before, but that's, in a way, a newcomer could much more readily accept that concept than the concept of the archetype.
Well, it makes very good sense that there are archetypes. As someone put it, is there any evidence of the collective unconscious? I have a colleague in France, a great professor of religion named Antoine Favre, Faivre. And when I brought up the idea that some people still say there's no evidence for the collective unconscious, he said in his French, well, the world behaves as if there was a collective unconscious. And I think that's just the kind of wonderful French intellectual, practical way of saying it. But in a sense, once you've said there's a cultural unconscious, you almost haven't said anything. I mean, it's sort of like, just of course there are elements to human experience that are common throughout the world, and it's not too surprising that people would form somewhat similar images of them. In other words, but in a sense, so what? How does it really grab us and get into us? And the answer is almost certainly through culture. In other words, there must be some built-in affectional system, as Harry Harlow was later to speak of it, that enables heterosexual love and homosexual love and all the variants. But there may be several affectional systems. Harlow used to say we had more, but what's really interesting is how we think about love on a daily basis, and that's very much shaped by our cultural expectations. I mean, our particular culture, we get it from movies and rock records, and by the age of 18, anybody who's had any exposure to media at all in this country has a very good idea of what love is supposed to be like. And so whatever archetypes may be embedded in all that, it's the cultural role modeling that we get, and the way our feelings are channeled along certain lines by the culture, that really allows us to get into the archetype, so to speak.
Okay, well, let's get in. There are so many paths that we could follow here and that I would love to follow, but I'm aware that your time will be limited. So let's begin to talk about Jung's theory of types. I'm under the impression that he developed that theory, at least in part, to try to make sense of his break with Freud.
One never knows why a psychologist develops a theory. I think it's sort of if you are psychologically creative, you'll be the last to know. So what we do know is that he came up with this great theory, and he had to tell other people why his mind had turned itself in this direction. And he says in some places that he developed the theory to explain the enormous differences between himself Freud and Adler, since he was part of the triumvirate that people constantly said in those days. There's a story of him going to the British library, the British Museum Library, in 1920, and he asks if he can use the stacks, and they ask for his identification, his name, and he says, I'm Professor Jung. And immediately the person said, oh, Freud, Jung, and Adler? And he said, no, just Jung. So you can see that he was that famous, and that triumvirate was that famous. So it was sort of like being part of almost a scandal, because here we had these three people with theories of the unconscious, and they couldn't really agree with each other or get along with each other. So he says that he developed the theory of psychological types for that. I think behind it are also many other people that are speaking to him in the question of what is a psychology anyway? And the two of those people, just to name two, are Friedrich Nietzsche, who had really pioneered the idea of perspectives. His ideas were sometimes called perspectivism, that every single mindset is a perspective, as Jung would say, is a different consciousness. And then there was William James, who had already started to divide people into the tough-minded and the tender-minded by about 1900. He had two different kinds of people.
I didn't know that went back to William James. Interesting.
Yeah, he was the origin of that. And then even beyond that, and this is the person Jung never names, but he was in Paris, and he was reading his work in around 1902. Alfred Binet, B-I-N-E-T, we know the name from the Stanford mm-hmm. Binet Test of Intelligence. And Binet was studying human intelligence, and so he used as his prime example his two daughters. And one of them really oriented entirely in an extroverted way, and another in an introverted way. And he came up with terms that were French near equivalents to extroversion and introversion. He didn't quite have the... he had externospection was one of them, and the other had something with intro in it. So he was definitely the type idea was in the air. There was the idea that not everyone thinks the same, and I think that's the beginning of psychology. I think psychology in the modern sense really begins when you recognize that not everyone thinks the same. And what Jung was really saying when he broke with Freud was that this attempt to create a universal theory based on one complex and at that time only one drive, sexuality, Oedipus complex, and one drive, the sexual drive, that would be absolutely universal and thus create the basis for a science of the mind, which was Freud's dream, was profoundly unpsychological, because the basis of psychology is that we are not all the same. We all think differently, and one has to be a kind of anthropologist going into each psyche as you would go into so many different cultures, and without any presupposition about what that culture's rules and norms are going to be, you have to find them out for yourself. And Jung simply felt that the attempt to try to impose a model of the mind on the psyche was exactly what it didn't need. What needed was this kind of empathic understanding, which would start with the premise that not everyone uses the mind in the same way. So it seems to me that that was the true origin of psychological types, and then explaining the differences between himself and Freud and Adler was almost secondary to this being a true assertion of what he felt psychology itself should be. So when he says psychological types, that word psychological is critically important, and his basic criticism of Freud is that Freud was trying to be some kind of scientist, and that that itself was not really psychological. Something different needed to come into being, and it wasn't just going to be another science like anatomy. It was going to be different, and it was going to be grounded in a sense of the individuality of psyche. And so he was really writing this book to explain why he had such a violent resistance to Freud. Not so much that his type was different from Freud, but that his whole approach to psychology was different, and he couldn't finally accept Freud and be loyal to Freud as Freud wanted, because he had a different view of what psyche itself was.
Okay, well, that's
so the book he puts it together in.
Yes. Thank you for giving us that very rich sense of context. Let me have you now take us through the types and tell us about their significance and dynamics.
Well, the remarkable thing is that Jung up until that point was many different things, but he never was more specific than in his type theory. The starting point for him was that William James idea that there were more or less two types of people. And he also noticed that the kinds of patients Freud was treating as a neurologist working with an outpatient practice specializing in hysterical neuroses and then eventually obsessive compulsive neuroses was a very different group of people than Jung as a psychiatrist in the main psychiatric hospital in Central Europe, which was at that time headed in Zurich by Bleuler, who came up with the term schizophrenia while Jung was working as his first assistant. And I've often thought Jung may have had a role in coming up with that name along with Bleuler. And so he was seeing really people of the same kind I saw when I worked in a state mental hospital, seriously mentally ill people. Today we would say the people with schizophrenias particularly, but also manic depressive psychoses. And he was working with a much different population, and particularly the schizophrenic population was not like the so-called hysteric population of Freud, and naturally the schizophrenic people were far more withdrawn and preoccupied with images that Jung soon enough recognized had parallels in mythology and eventually what he was to call archetypes. So he was dealing with people who were very withdrawn and caught up in private mental processes, as opposed to the hysterics who were extremely reactive to other people and to the emotional field between other people. So early on he thought, well, maybe there are two types of a patient and two types of psychology, and one is sort of the introverted type, one is the extroverted type. And those days he thought the extroverted type had some kind of overdevelopment of feeling, and the introverted type had some kind of obsessive relation to thinking. So he had sort of an early model that there were two types, the introverted thinking type and the extroverted feeling type, and Freud psychology might be adequate for the extroverted feeling type, but something else was needed for the introverted thinking type, and that was what Jung was trying to develop in his work. Now, Freud couldn't stand that because it struck right at the heart of the idea that there's a universal science of mind based on a commonality of experience between all of us. And he also didn't really, Freud, like and see the advantages of descriptive psychiatry and thought that was different from dynamic psychiatry, whereas with Jung, the description always implied a dynamic underneath. So when Jung presented this idea for the first time in 1913, it was seen as a very bad thing by Freud and the psychoanalysts. And when he published the book Psychological Types 8 years later, now no longer a Freudian psychoanalyst, Freud essentially dismissed the book because he said, well, this is no longer depth psychology at all. It's just because by then Jung had elaborated the description into not just two types, but he now had extroversion and introversion as a pair of attitudes that were expressed through different, what he called, functions of consciousness, and he named them thinking, feeling, sensation, and intuition. And for the longest time, nobody seemed to know what this meant, and this was something that you only learned if you got into Jungian circles. Nowadays, it's so well known through the Myers-Briggs type indicator that I dare say that there are likely to be more people in this country who, at this moment, who know what extroversion, introversion, thinking, feeling, sensation, intuition is, than who really know what id, ego, and superego is. It's the strangest thing, but the type theory has really caught on. And even movie makers in screenplay classes are taught the type theory so they can make characters that will work on the screen. It's that kind of thing.
Yeah, I've been shocked to see just how widespread the Myers-Briggs is used in the business world.
People make hundreds of thousands of dollars a year sometimes in consulting practices teaching how type theory can be used in personality management, and their books about vocational placement with titles like Be What You Are.
Yes.
We find we get the best work out of people if we communicate with them and allow them to work with their strengths and not to try to conform them to one model, which is the way we do things here, and that's sort of where American personnel management has been going, and these courses are extremely popular and I think very helpful to team building and other things.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the people earn the money. The money is well spent because people spend most of their working lives more and more in these jobs. And it's sort of wonderful to think that people are in those places are actually trying to tap the different kinds of intelligence people have, which is how I see types. I see types as a range of intelligences that we all have. Very much like Howard Gardner's cognitive psychology in a book, very famous book, Frames of Mind, where he names, I think initially, seven intelligences in the first version of the book, and if you look closely, they correspond rather well to seven of Jung's psychological types. The only one he doesn't cover is the one Jung calls introverted intuition. By the time Jung wrote Psychological Types in 1921, he had turned essentially introversion and extroversion into adjectives so that they appeared in relation to functions of consciousness, so that it's probably better to say introverted thinking and extroverted thinking and introverted feeling and extroverted feeling and introverted sensation and extroverted sensation and introverted intuition and extroverted intuition. And then you get an eight-function model, or we technical word, eight-function attitude model, which is the one that I've been pioneering. But you see it right in Jung in the last chapter 10 of Psychological Types, where he actually takes each of the functions and shows what it looks like in the introverted and the extroverted attitude. So four functions, thinking, feeling, sensation, intuition, and two attitudes, introversion, extroversion, end up with these eight psychological types, eight types of human intelligence. And that's cognitive psychology about 40 years before its time.
Mm-hmm. I was struck by your reference to your own pioneering work. So tell us how you have, in your own work, kind of taken it beyond.
Well, when you learn Jung, you learn all these different wonderful contributions he made. So some people have compared his work to a cathedral with different rooms or different turrets, and so one of the turrets might be psychological types, and another might be archetypes, and yet another is the theory of complexes, because it was really Jung who advanced that too. Freud would not have used the term Oedipus complex if he'd not met Jung, because Jung was the one who was working on complexes before he met Freud, and Jung was already a little more famous than Freud and when they met, because he worked out a way of talking about the complexes of people with schizophrenia. So the famous book, The Psychology of Dementia Praecox, was read all over the psychiatric world shortly after its publication in 1907. And Freud felt that psychoanalysis could kind of enter psychiatry through the theory of the complex, and Jung was the general who would take it there. Then later, Jung got the idea that every complex has at its heart an archetype, and so he got really more interested in the theory of archetypes than the theory of complexes, though he never lost full interest in either. Then came the theory of psychological types, and nobody knew what to do with it. What I've done in my work is to see that every single complex can be typed. It actually, every single complex that we see in a dream or in our lives is associated with a psychological type. Moreover, every complex does have an archetypal core. Turning it from the other angle, every psychological type is expressed through an archetype. So that in me, for example, extroverted feeling, which is in my list of functions, what we would call my third function, if we take my where I discovered Jung by just following my nose, that's about as good an example of what extroverted intuition is like as I can give you.
Mm-hmm.
And the way I think is rather private. I never quite define anything the same way twice, and I'm always going inside to say my ideas, so that one has the peculiar experience sometimes, perhaps you've had it already, of someone in a sense talking to himself. But what I'm really doing is going inside and making sure that what I'm saying matches up to some sense within me that it's true. That's introverted thinking. So extroverted intuition, introverted thinking, pretty much defines this strange rambling talk and private referencing that you would doubtless experience in me.
So those would be your two dominant modes.
Two dominant functions.
Mm-hmm.
But my third function is extroverted feeling. And there, people who know me and experience me, and often patients, pick up a definitely childlike quality to me. That extroverted feeling is associated with the archetype of the puer eternus. It has a kind of eternal boy-like quality. When I'm in my extroverted feeling, it's almost like I'm an 8-year-old child sharing his discovery with another 8-year-old child and having this kind of excited conversation about something they've just discovered together. I mean,
mm-hmm.
It all but says, gee, you know. It's that kind of thing. And if you go back to my leading functions, I think there was something courageous, ambitious, fearless about my finding my way to Jungian psychiatry in my mind so early. I mean, daring to think about that when I was not just saying, well, you know, I have plenty of time to decide, but to actually, almost like Babe Ruth pointing his bat at the place in the stands and then sitting a home run. I said, I'm going to be a psychiatrist when I'm 19, and I am a psychiatrist. And I did, and I was hearing about the Jungian analyst who was living the self-sacrificing life, and I followed in his footsteps. And I did come to San Francisco, and I did train, and I went all the way. So in a sense, that would be the heroic function. You can feel the hero archetype there. And when I teach and I try to explain things, that's where my introverted thinking comes in. And I really do take an effort to try to be as clear as I can and try to say it the way I think it ought to be said so that people will get it right and not just get something out of a book that they read and try to apply and they can't use. That's my introverted thinking, and when I teach, I try to use that in a fatherly way. So if you look at my first three functions, you've got a hero, and you've got a father, and you've got a pueriternus. Now, this isn't very different from transactional analysis, where they speak of a parent, an adult, and a child as three different states, except that I'm calling them psychological types carried by archetypes, and I have something certainly that transactional analysis doesn't have. Through the Jungian lens, I can say that my hero has a certain type. My adult has a certain type, and my parent has a certain type, and my child has a certain type. Puer eternus means eternal boy, or puella eterna, eternal girl. So it's really the child, the eternal child in all of us, or as one of my patients called it, the endless boy, the endless boy. So those three states of mind have a lot to do with my everyday functioning, and in each one of them is a different type. And in analysis, I look at dreams to see how the different types of consciousness show up in dreams. And are they in good shape or are they in bad shape? Are they afflicted? How are they doing? Mm-hmm. And I try to help them operate as well as they can. That's the differentiation of consciousness. I mean, having those three functions gives me a range of options that I wouldn't have if I was stuck in one or the other, or even worse, if one of them hadn't really been born yet, if it was still stuck in the birth canal. And so there are many people who've never found their hero. And that was why Joseph Campbell was so thrilling to so many when he told people to follow their bliss. He actually gave lots of people permission to come forward with their heroic function and do what they really wanted to do with their lives. And that was the man who'd written The Hero with a Thousand Faces, encouraging mass audience to develop their own individual heroism, and that coincided with the rise of interest in psychological types, with the MBTI, which the Myers-Briggs type indicator, where people all over this country began to reflect on who they really were and whether it was possible to live and work and actually earn money following one's bliss, so to speak, as Campbell was saying. So that whole self-development, the burgeoning of self-help books, is all in a way hero psychology. But now what suffered was our ability to take care of each other, and so the father function, the mother function, really got very undeveloped. And so that's the function you use when you take care of other people and show a sense of social responsibility and they're conscious of how you take care of other people. And that in our particular culture, in America today, is an area that's very much at risk, very problematic, and it shows up when we try to find a president. We keep trying to find a father or mother we can trust, and nobody feels we can. Right now we all have the idea of which one we can trust, which one is reliable, which one has the most experience, which one is most steady, which one is most inspiring. And the arguments go back and forth. Who really is going to be the good father? But all that shows how poignantly and how sadly we have all failed to develop that very much of that function in ourselves in recent years.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. Now,
that's what my work really is freeing that up. And finding the lines along which it will naturally develop in an individual.
Yes. Now, speaking of your work and your teaching, I wanted to share with you that my wife, a few years back, was listening to a series of tapes of lectures that you had given, and she discovered her type with a real aha as a result of listening to your tape. She realized that she was I believe, extroverted intuitive. And that had a lot of meaning for her because suddenly she realized, okay, this explains what I'm good at. Now I understand why I'm so good at some things and so poor at some other things. And for her, it was a big breakthrough. And yet she had been trying to figure out her type for some time. She was actually seeing a Jungian analyst, and she'd say, okay, I think I'm this type. And the analyst would say, no, you haven't got it quite yet. So on the one hand, we have the Myers-Briggs, which makes it sound like, oh, it's really easy to figure out your type. On the other hand, there are people who say, well, it could take you years to figure out your type.
Well, it's a terrible problem to figure out type, and I would say that anyone who thinks they can get it from taking a paper and pencil test is extremely naive, because you don't know which part of you is taking the test. And I believe we all have all eight function attitudes within us somewhere, and under certain circumstances we'll use one and under others another. I myself had the devil of a time figuring out whether I was an extrovert or an introvert, and that was something like 7 years into my analysis and 2 years or so years into my training to be a Jungian analyst, and I wondered if they, as we often do in the educational system, if they'd made a mistake accepting me into the program, because I couldn't tell even whether I was an extrovert or an introvert. And it was then that I learned this idea from the Myers-Briggs creators, Isabel Briggs Myers and her mother, Catherine Briggs, had the idea that if the first function is extroverted, the second function is introverted. And when that was explained to me by an analyst named Wayne Detloff in 1972, it just amazed me. I thought, oh my goodness. In other words, I'm extroverted under certain circumstances and introverted under others. So I use my extroversion in dealing with people in certain categories of my life, but I use my introversion in others. And that explained why some of my friends were sure I was extroverted and others said I was the only introvert they knew.
Well, that makes a lot of sense to me. That really is very helpful.
That really was useful.
Mm-hmm. To acknowledge that
that must have happened to your wife too. And what she probably heard was the mirror, because I talked about my own experience as an extroverted intuitive, and it began to add up to her as what she was like.
Yes, I think you told some stories about yourself, and she realized that it was very similar to her own profile.
And that's what I think we should all be doing, is tell our own story of how we experience these things in our own lives. And then that, just hearing that, you can begin sort of like the This American Life of the psyche. If we tell the stories, it pretty much becomes clear after a while, oh, I see, if that's what introverted feeling is like, I've sure got it, that kind of thing.
Well, I hate to draw this to a close, but you're your thought there that we each need to tell our own story is a perfect close. So I'm going to say, Dr. John Beebe, thanks so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, you've been a marvelously enabling interviewer and made all the space for an extroverted intuitive to go where he wants to go, which is never the same place in the same way. But if you got that I was being myself, you got a lot today. I enjoyed it, is what I mean.
I do hope you enjoyed this conversation with Jungian analyst Dr. John Beebe. Something I've said about myself jokingly over the years is that I'm that psychological type which is resistant to psychological typology. I'm not sure what type that would make me in the Jungian scheme of things. I understand the rationale behind Jungian typology and have a bit of a grasp of the theory, but somehow it's never been a part of Jungian psychology that really speaks to me deeply. And I've felt equally resistant to other sorts of typologies, ranging from astrological to the Enneagram, among others. I do understand that each of these have been deeply meaningful to many other people. As I think I mentioned in the interview, my own wife was thrilled when she finally figured out that she is an extroverted intuitive. And coincidentally, that was after listening to a series of tapes by John Beebe some years ago. She continues to talk about it, though, and she says everything fell into place at that point, helping her to understand why she's good at the things that she's good at and not so good at other things. I think the thing I like about Dr. Beebe's approach, as it comes across in this interview, is the recognition that we each have all four functions and both attitudes at play in our personalities. If I understand him correctly, we all have bits of introversion and extroversion, thinking, feeling, intuition, and sensation, and that various combinations of these will be called out depending upon the situations in which we find ourselves. That would help to resolve some of my personal resistance to typology, inasmuch as I always seem to see myself in all of the categories, regardless of the typological system in question.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
Well, we had a nice run of about 5 days on the main podcast page in the iTunes store, which apparently brought us hundreds of new subscribers. So welcome to all you new listeners. I'm afraid we've dropped off that page now, but the logo is still featured right in the center of the higher education page. I hope you'll help us stay there by staying subscribed. And by the way, if you are listening but haven't subscribed, please do so. You'll find a link on our website that will help you to subscribe on iTunes, and you can also subscribe at our sponsor's site at podshow.com/shrinkwrapradio. As I've mentioned before, I'm going to be in Barcelona in early May, and I'd love to meet with one or more of you there. So if you're anywhere in the environs of Barcelona, let's plan to get together. We haven't had any new additions to our Frapper map in some time. Do put yourself there if you haven't already. There's a link on our website to make it easy for you. My interview with the internationally renowned author and Stanford psychiatrist, Dr. Irvin Yalom, is now available on my other podcast series, which you'll find at www.wisecounselpodcast.com. And the focus is on his new book, Dealing with Overcoming Death Anxiety. So that's a good one. Check out our website for other features, such as flyers that you can post at your local university that kind of help to promote the show, and also T-shirts that have our logo, all sorts of T-shirts in various sizes and designs and colors. So do check that out. Our sponsors are Podshow and GoDaddy, where you can use our discount code of SHRINK3 at checkout on GoDaddy to save 10% on your next domain name purchase.
Yeah, you should really listen to that Dr. Dave show. A lot of people are tuning in. It's extremely popular. And I've met Dr. Dave a couple times and listened to his show and liked it very much. There's a lot of good stuff there. And for those of you who are into what your mind is doing, it's an interesting little piece of your body. What's going on in your head? You might want to check it out. Shrink Wrap Radio, shrinkwrapradio.com.
Thanks very much for that ringing endorsement, Adam Curry of the Daily Source Code, and of course, Podshow. Adam is otherwise known as the Podfather. Now let's go to some recent emails. Jack writes to say that the recent show on Buddhist happiness, number 137, was a great surprise. The show and guests were engaging and delightful, as are many of your shows, he says. I'm going back over O'Hanlon, Rosenblatt, Violdo, and Miller, and have to wonder, as a layperson, why there are so many types of therapy, and why do they all claim to work? Do you think we can return to that topic in a future show? Also, I'd like to hear a show, or at least part of a show, on how to choose a therapist or a type of therapy, and how to assess progress in therapy. Many thanks and all best wishes, Jack. Well, Jack, that's a great suggestion for a future show. I'm not sure there's a simple, easy answer, you know, a single answer to that question about how to choose a therapist, because it really depends a lot upon the match between the person and the therapist. But I can try to find one or more guests maybe who will speak some more to that issue. And of course, part of the reason why there's so many different types of therapy and why they all claim to work, you know, is when it comes right down to it, there are people trying to make a reputation for themselves. And, you know, at some level, the practice of psychotherapy is a business. And for some people, it's a bigger business than others. So that's my jaundiced view of a longtime veteran. Now, Patrick wrote to call my attention to some software that you can download from Version Tracker. It's Macintosh software. I don't know if it exists for Windows or not. If you've never gone to the site versiontracker.com, it's a great place for finding and downloading software, particularly free software and shareware. And this program that he's called my attention to is named Dream Recorder 2.1. So I think if you do a search for that on Version Tracker, or even just using Google, you should be able to track it down. And it's an interesting piece of software that you can use with a Mac. Again, I don't know if it works with Windows, but you can use it in combination with the Mac's built-in EyeSight camera and have it actually looking at you as you're sleeping. And it records every time that you roll over in your sleep, it records those movements in your sleep. And then it will also wake you up, I guess, and give you an opportunity to record whatever dreams you remember. It's got a number of options, but that's part of it, is that by the movements in your sleep, it's able to guess when you're in REM sleep and to wake you up right after that. Well, I have to say, I personally don't have sufficient motivation to become lucid and to study the content of my dreams to want to be woken up repeatedly during the night. Again, as a jaundiced veteran, there probably was a point earlier in my career and in my youth where I would have been motivated to do that. And so I do share this information with the rest of you who, in fact, might be motivated to do it. And if you do, please contact us and let us know what you experienced. Then I got another email, again from Jack, the first emailer that I read from, with a short email that says, is there any evidence to support the notion that watching other people's therapy is itself therapeutic? And he says, I'm of course referring to that HBO video series, In Treatment. Best regards, Jack. Hey, that's a great question, Jack. And I don't know of actual research studies that suggest that watching other people's therapy is therapeutic. But I have to say that I think it is. In fact, I feel like I learned things from when I was a therapist. I felt that I learned things vicariously from clients as I watched them work through issues. Certainly, I feel like we learn things vicariously when we read case histories and books and therapy type books. And also, when you think about group therapy, I think that's part of the rationale for group therapy, is that people will learn vicariously, members of the group, you know, one person may be on the hot seat and the others are watching. And I think that there is a certain kind of learning that takes place. You know, there's a lot of evidence for learning through modeling, or what's called vicarious learning, among animals, you know, among primates and even below primates, and moving on up the scale, the phylogenetic scale. So it seems perfectly reasonable to me that, yes, there's considerable learning that can happen. I feel like I'm learning from watching In Treatment. I'm still enjoying that series quite a bit. Very dramatic. I'm totally wrapped up in it. And at the same time, I don't think that vicarious learning is a substitute for a full course of psychotherapy. If that's, you know, something that you really need in your life, I don't think it's going to be a substitute, but I think it can help move you along the way. It can certainly help you to learn what the process is like, what to expect, what some of the difficulties might be, and the challenges, and so on. Now I'll wrap up with one more email. And this comes from Sarah up in Toronto, who writes, "You mentioned a couple of podcasts ago that people who send in a positive review to iTunes should send a copy to you, and then you would send them a book from one of your authors. And yes, I'm willing to do that. I've reined it in a little bit because I found that it was getting very expensive to send to people who are in other countries. But Sarah, I think I could send something to you in Canada. I think that's not too expensive to send to Canada from here. The other downside, unfortunately, is I've discovered that people who post in Canada on iTunes, it doesn't show up in the iTunes that we see here in the U.S. So I don't know how helpful it is to me. Well, it's helpful, I guess, to help other Canadians discover it. Getting back to Sarah's note, she says, "Well, I've been trying for days to find out how to get a review to iTunes and into iTunes. I'm not hugely computer savvy, but I just cannot find the process for letting them know how much I love your podcast. If you tell me how to do it, I'll try again." So I've suggested to Sarah that if she wants to give me a call, I'll try to walk her through it, although the Canadian process may be different than the U.S. process. You know, basically it involves going to the iTunes store, then going into the podcast area, and you might have to sign up with the store and give them a credit card number. That may be the issue. I'm not sure. Even though the podcast is free, even though you're not going to be spending any money in the store, that may be required to kind of become, quotes, an iTunes member, if you will. Sarah goes on to say, "I'm a professional practitioner in private practice, and I've been looking for high-quality psychology podcasts as a way to continually upgrade, and I found it in Shrink Wrap. Your show is informative and interesting and entertaining all at once. I have been recommending your show to my clients. You're correct in saying that the show is appropriate for professionals and lay people alike. By the way, I'd love to be a guest on your show. I have a particular mission: to remove verbal abuse from family life, including yelling, name-calling, and otherwise hurting loved ones. I've written a book, the title of which is Raise Your Kids Without Raising Your Voice. I know so many people listen to your podcast, including mental health professionals. I know that speaking with you can really help get my message out there, so if you have any interest in this topic, please contact me. In any event, I really want to thank you for producing this show. Please keep it up. By the way, I also just had my second grandchild. It's so wonderful. I like hearing about your growing family, too. All the best." And that comes from Sarah. And I'm not sure how you pronounce your middle name, Shana Radcliffe. And I mentioned her full name because, sure, I'd love to have her on as a guest, and I've contacted her to let her know that, and I'm sure you'll be hearing her on here before long. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave voicemails on Skype where our name is ShrinkPod. You can leave voicemails using the MyChingo logo on our website. Been some time since we've had any voicemail. I really like it. Or you can leave a voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. Thanks again to Dr. John Beebe for sharing his work on Jungian typology. My next guest will be Nancy Hunter, another listener in Toronto, who is also a psychotherapist who does interesting things with hypnotic dream work and EFT, emotional freedom technique. I hope you'll join us for that show. This is Dr. Dave saying it's all in your mind.